fans. How you doing? It's your boy, Jonathan Macri, with you on this very happy Halloween. And it is indeed a happy Halloween for me, because I have the pleasure of being joined right now. I could read off his list of accolades, all of the books that he has written, which one after another, New York Times bestsellers, including the current book that he is promoting right now, Expensive Basketball, which I am holding up in front of my camera. This is my press copy. The nice hardcover edition is even better than this. If you could somehow get better than this, which I don't know. Can you get better than something that is perfect? I don't know if you can get better than something that is perfect. I don't really give a shit about any of that. What I care about is I get to spend the next 25 or so minutes talking to one of my idols in the writing game. And that is, of course, Jay Serrano. How you doing, man?
What is up? What is up? You know what I just learned on this go round for the books is whenever I'm writing, I'm in it, and I don't want to stop to like find a piece of information, right? This is a behind the scenes thing. But when I'm writing and I don't want to stop to like look up a stat or what like an actual detail was or a specific year and I'm not certain, I would just put in brackets. I'd be like, and then Steph Curry, da 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 da, and then brackets, and I'll put game number, whatever, and then keep it moving because I want to. So I didn't know that when the publisher sends out the press copy, it has that version of the chapter in there. I was so embarrassed to find that out. It's like a tracking sample for a rap song. You know, sometimes rappers, when they're making a song, they don't know what they're gonna say, but they know how they want to say it, and they're just like recording themselves going da 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 da.
I'm gonna pretend that I know that, but continue.
Okay. All right. And that's what it felt like. I was like, oh, man, I didn't want people to see that part of the book. I didn't know the publisher did that. So, but my you have it. Part, you're one of the few.
My favorite part was in the table of contents. I don't know if people could see this. It's all zeros.
It's all there zeros. Is, it's just like.
It's all zeros. It's all chapter zero. Yeah. You know why? Because none of these chapters should be ranked better than any of the other chapters. They are all equal. And thus they must all be triple zero. That's the only explanation. Congratulations, man. The book fucking rocks. But everybody knows that because it's already like, I saw your tweet yesterday. It's like 200 something on the Amazon, like all of Amazon books, not like sports, but it's like 200 almost Amazon. I got to think like the first 200 some odd of those are like different editions of the Bible. So really, you're like probably like in the top 30 when you move away all of the Bible sales.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think the highest we got was maybe like 4 or 5 one time, like overall on Amazon, which is crazy because there are 33 million books on there. But yeah, it's always, the book comes out, you're always nervous, you're always hopeful that people will buy it. But more than that, you're hopeful that I would rather a book like only sell a small amount of copies, but the copies that it did sell went to a person read it and was like, oh, this is cool. This means something to me. You know what I mean? So it's always nice to hear somebody say, oh, I liked it. I read the thing and I liked it.
I didn't like it. I loved it. but I'm also biased because so look, I'm going to be selfish and I'm going to spend this time talking about you and your little process as a writer, because I'm going to start at the something I was going to save till later, but kind of since you just made me think of it, you write in a way that nobody else writes, which is what I think correlates directly to what you just said. You want the people that buy it to truly love it. And I think when you write in a way that nobody else writes, the odds increase that you will elicit that genuine love from a person. It's like, man, I've never gotten this from anywhere else. My question to you is, when you write in the way that you write, where you are putting yourself out there in a way where you're writing in a way where I'm sure you look at some things that you write sometimes and you're like, well, this is utterly ridiculous. And but you have that trust in yourself and the confidence in yourself to leave those words on the page. So I'm curious if, like, still now 10 years into your career as a full-time writer, almost 20 years into your career as a writer, period, do you still get those moments where you're like, can I really put this sentence in this book? Or do you still have those doubts?
When I'm like writing it, just writing it to write it, I don't worry too much about that part, right? Because that's what the editor's for. Like, the editor will tell me, hey, this isn't making any sense, right? Like, I always enjoy if I have an editor who is like not an expert in the thing that I'm writing about, because then I can write it how I want to write it and put it in front of them. And then if it makes sense to them, then great, I did my job, because they, you know, if I wrote a basketball email and I sent it to you, I can probably write that a little differently than a basketball email that I could send to like my wife. There's some stuff I don't have to say in the right. So you have to figure out a way to like bridge the gap between those two things. But to your point, yeah, when I'm writing, I don't think much about what I should or shouldn't try. I just sort of trust my instinct at this point, my gut. And then I also rely on like the trust that I have with the readers. Most of the people who are going to buy this book, this won't be the first book of mine that they bought. They have, you know, they've read the stuff before. They sort of know what's going to happen. So if you're reading a chapter, you open the book and you start with a Tim Duncan chapter, and then like 200 words into it, it breaks away and there's just like a poem from the 1800s. The reader who has experience with the stuff I've written will go like, I don't know what this is, but I know it's going to get us somewhere. And they'll just sort of have a trust with it. We're going to arrive at a point. And so when I'm writing, that's all I'm thinking about, is like, I'll just try this stuff.
Then the better question is probably, how long did it take you as a writer to develop that level of confidence to write in the style that is unequivocally yours and like unapologetically, like this is just what it's going to be?
I think that takes a number of years. Typically what happens if you're a young writer, if you're a young podcaster, when you're starting out doing a thing, you show up and you are recreating the people who have influenced you, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're like, oh, this is my favorite writer and she did this thing in her book. I'm going to try it too. And then you try it and you like try it on and see how it fits. And you're doing that in the beginning of your career. You're just sort of ripping off your idols until eventually it turns into your own version of a thing. Like, I think this is like a part of the reason I like basketball so much, because you see the same thing happen with a basketball player. You'd be like, oh, this, he's doing the Jordan move, right? Like when Kobe first started, you were like, oh, he's doing Jordan's move right here. He's doing Larry Bird's move, right? We watched him literally pick up Dirk Nowitzki's one-legged fadeaway. He was like, oh, I saw Dirk doing this. It's very effective. I'm going to incorporate it into my game. So you see him grabbing pieces of a game, and then eventually he sort of mushes it all together and turns it into something new that only Kobe does. And then the players who came behind him were like, oh, you're doing what Kobe did. And then they turn it into their new thing here. I think you're just sort of a byproduct of your influences. And so in my case, you know, I'm ripping off Chuck Klosterman and I'm ripping off Bill Simmons. Like, I have a list of guys and women who I read their stuff and was like, oh, this is Doreen St. Felix. Like, she writes in a way that's interesting. Hunter Harris, she writes in a way that's interesting. I'm going to take things I see other writers do, sort of run it through my algorithm, my internal algorithm, and hopefully it turns into it takes a number of years. Everybody's terrible when they start.
Yeah, I write a Knicks newsletter also, and I've been doing it now for 7 years. And I would say probably for the first like 2 to 3, there would be one day where I'd be writing like Bill Simmons, the next day where I'd be writing like Zach Lowe, the next day where,
right?
You know, 50-50. And then eventually you settle in on it. But that's going to lead to my next thing, because I think there's a number of conversions you go through as a writer, and I have not made the conversion that I'm about to ask you about, which is why I'm about to ask you about it, because you used to write mostly short form and then eventually you took the leap into books. Did you, I know it's a while ago now, but did you find that leap to be challenging?
Because it's a new way to write. If you're writing for the internet, right, like a blog post or whatever, all you have to think about is how is this going to play for like the next 2 days. That's it. Yeah. You can use whatever sort of language you want, meaning like if a word is cool right now, you can write it into your thing, or like a joke or whatever. You can put it in there and not worry about how it's going to look in a year or two, because most people are not going to read the thing in a year or two. And I don't mean like a problematic thing. I mean like a style.
Yeah, no, I know.
Like a style wise thing. Right. Whenever you're writing for like the internet, you are writing in like a faster version of it. With a book, you have to sort of plan, okay, this book is going to take me a couple of years to write, and I need the end of it to sound like the beginning of it. So I can't write it with like a modern sort of lexicon here. I need to write it in stone. I need for it to last for a while. And that's what you try to do. It doesn't always work, but you try to do that. So when you're first like learning how to do that, it's like a tricky thing because you're not used to it. Any new thing you're going to learn, especially with writing, it's going to take you a while to get into it. I remember when I did the Rap Yearbook, which was like the first, this 2015, the first like book that I did. I wrote the first like two or three chapters. Like I just wrote them like normal. And then by the time I got to the end, I went back and I read them, and I'm like, this doesn't sound like the other chapter. I had to change all of the stuff. Like that's, you know, it's a process, but yeah, it's hard to do, but also it's like kind of fun to figure out.
Yeah, I imagine. So getting into this book, it's called Expensive Basketball. I'm always curious about process to arrive at where you ended up getting to, because the book, I don't know if I want to spoil for people who may not have the book yet why it's called Expensive Basketball. I will ask you though, did you think of that term early on and then more of the concept for the book came after that, or was it vice versa and you arrived at like that phrase later on?
I arrived at the phrase later on. Right. First, you have to settle on what the idea is going to be. What's going to be the point of the book? And then once you do that, all of my other book titles were like crazy long, like basketball and other things, a collection of essays, illustrated, like questions asked, answered, illustrated, whatever. Fucking 25 words long for the title. I knew for this one, I wanted it to feel different. I'm like, I'm going to go with a very short title with no subtitle. It's just going to be like, it needs to represent a feeling. And but that's after you establish, okay, I know what the book is going to be. So for me, it comes, what's the idea first? Let's figure out the quickest, fastest, smartest way to present that idea after that.
So if I was to characterize the book, I would say it is a love letter to basketball, but that could mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So for me, I'm like, what's amazing about the book is I am the prototypical basketball reference rabbit hole. I will get stuck on my computer for a half an hour or 45 minutes or God knows how long. And I've like, what did I just waste my time? Oh, I'm looking at the 1993 Charlotte Hornets, which you read an eloquent chapter about. And I've accomplished nothing. But at the same time, like it is ultimately the artistry and the magic and the feeling you get watching the game that, continues to draw me to it year after year. You blend these two things together. And again, I'm going to go back to the beginning. Was that always kind of something you had in mind?
For the book?
Yes, for the book.
Yeah. That was definitely what I had in mind. So the idea here is the book is not a refutation of stats, right? There are plenty of stats in the book. What the book proposes, what I propose as a basketball fan, is that a number has never made anybody fall in love with basketball. Whatever your nobody has been like, oh my God, Steph Curry shot 9 threes last night without any other framework. Like nobody goes, oh wow, 9 threes, that means a lot to me. That's not what meant a lot to you. What meant a lot to you was the feeling that you got when you were watching it happen. That's always the first thing. And I think that that is the most important part of watching basketball. I think that's why basketball is meaningful. I think that's why you have posters and signed basketballs and stuffed animals behind you, because watching each of those players made you feel something that nothing else did. No other thing did. And so when I was making the book, I said, well, that's the thing that I want to write about, because that's the most important part of the game to me. This, I love stats. I love talking about stats. I love mentioning championships and arguing player efficiency ratings and whatever. Like, that's all very interesting to me, of course. But the most important thing is never a number. It's always, how did I feel? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So this is what I've been doing. Every time this conversation comes up with whoever's asking me this question, I want to ask you, because you will have an answer here. Give me like a basketball memory that you have that you love, like just a thing you watched happen in a game. It could be anything, just any possible thing.
I'll give you one you mentioned in the book. I think in the miscellaneous chapter, Houston's game winner in '99 against the Heat.
Allen Houston's game winner in 1999 against the Miami Heat in the playoffs. Okay, so when that play happened, when Allen Houston gets the ball, the clock is running down, you're in Miami, he's at the free throw line, he jumps to shoot it, he's leaning forward. Remember, he's like sort of falling forward as he lets the ball go. It doesn't drop straight in. It hits the rim, then comes up, then hits the back, and then goes in and he runs down the court. When that ball hit the rim and then went up toward the backboard, no New York Knicks fan, nobody in the New York metropolitan area said to themselves, oh my God, if this goes in, Allen Houston's going to be 9 for 13 from the field. Nobody said that. Nobody thought of a number. You just thought, oh my God, if this ball goes in, oh my, please God, like you were filled with a feeling that you probably wouldn't get again for who knows how long, probably hadn't had since Larry Johnson's 4-point play. You were filled with like an emotion. It's very specific to watching a basketball thing happen. That's what you thought of first before any numbers. That's the thing that you thought of. And I think every single basketball person, even the nerdiest, the John Hollinger-iest numbers, Daryl Morey-iest numbers guy, when you ask him, what's your like first memory of this basketball thing? It's never, ever a number. And so that's what I want my book to be. I want my book to be, there'll be numbers in there, but they're always in service of this other thing.
And which is why I think it made perfect sense that you opened with a chapter on Tim Duncan. Obviously you're a Spurs fan, rooting for Spurs unabashedly for a very long time. And I thought that was such a poignant choice because, Tim Duncan so often gets not pigeonholed, but like he's the boring superstar, right? He's the most boring superstar of all time. Right. And then you manage to write about him in a way where it's like, well, no, actually, if you watched him day in and day out, and again, you use the numbers to like support the feeling, not the other way around. And that's what makes it beautiful. A couple more, and I know we're already kind of running long. So I love the book. However, I'm not able to attest to whether the chapter on Reggie Miller was any good or not because I skipped it. Because with all due respect to the gentleman who made you fall in love with basketball, fuck Reggie Miller eternally. The man has caused me too much pain in my life. And I say that out of ultimate respect because he's one of the greatest basketball players who ever lived. You wrote about some players and some moments that caused you as a Spurs fan a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, man, it's still – I've been doing the content creation thing for a while. It's still tough for me to do that, and you do it really well. So I just want – that's not even a question. I just wanted to give you a compliment on that because it's really cool. I guess I got to ask, how do you do that? But you're really good at it.
I think that part is important, right? I think having your heart broken is like – that's part of the appeal. It's never exciting if nothing is risked. You know what I mean? That's why as much as I was terrified of Kobe and the Lakers, Those were always my favorite games to watch because the threat was there. The threat of like, these guys might come in here and kill you. They're going to come in here and try to destroy you. It was, you didn't feel like that when you're playing, when, you know, the Spurs are playing the, I don't know, the 2007 Cavs in the finals. I had zero worries that we were going to win that championship. I was certain we were going to sweep them, especially after game one. It's like, these guys don't, they can't guard us. They can't do anything and they can't score on us. We're fine, right? We won a championship that series, but it was not as nearly as exciting as any of the times we played the Lakers in the playoffs, even when we lost, because you go into it and you're like, it's like getting into a fight and you're going to get hit a few times and you sort of, you know, there's a very, it's a peculiar thing that happens. Even the worst wounds, basketball, like heartbreak wounds, age into cool, like battle scars. And they're fun to talk about after the fact. They still suck, but it's like, I lived through that and I'm good.
I would like to have a, championship to accompany the scars at some
point before help.
I die.
That does help.
You have five.
That does help.
And before I let you go, I will ask you one question about something that isn't in the book, because how could I have Chase Lorano on and not ask him a question about the extraterrestrial being that is currently laying siege on the league. So I will just ask you, does Victor Wembanyama have a chance to be the most expensive basketball player in the history of the NBA, sir?
Oh my goodness. He has the chance. He has a chance to do anything right now, is what it feels like. There's no like hypothetical that you could lay out that you don't go, well, maybe with Wemby. Like, not like from what we've seen, based on what we've seen, it doesn't matter what you'd be like, guess what? Year five, he's going to dunk it from the three-point line. That might happen. Who knows? He might actually do that. Like, that's the level that we're talking about here. This is the most excited I have ever been for a basketball player. I grew up in San Antonio.
Ever.
I was here, I was here pre-David Robinson. I was here when the Spurs were terrible. This is what I'm used to, right? David Robinson shows up. Spurs are good. We are now like championship contenders with David. Tim shows up. Now we're championship winners. We go from David to Tim, briefly to Kawhi Leonard. When we had Kawhi, I was like, oh, this guy's going to take over. That sort of fizzles out. He's gone. But we're used to basketball excellence, but we're also used to it looking a certain way and sounding a certain way and presenting itself in a certain way. And then Wemby shows up and he's got all of the stuff that the other guys have, the like work ethic, the integrity, if you will. Like, he seems like he's going to do things the right way. He cares about winning, but he's doing this new thing that's exciting and cool. Like, we have the cool basketball player and the guy who's going to scream and flex when he does the thing. And
like, doing it last night.
We've never had that before, ever. And so the fact that we have I think already the third best player in the league, at worst the fifth, I think it goes SGA, Joker, Wemby. That's what I think based on what I've seen so far. Like, you might be able to knock him down one or two spots, but he's not going to fall further than fifth, right?
We did the requisite MVP conversation on the last episode, so we're there with you.
We have that guy. And it's just so incredibly exciting. We're 5-0 right now. We've never been 5-0 in history. Wow. We were celebrating last night when they won that game like we had really done something. It was so exciting to see. Wemby was pumped. He talked about it beforehand. Hey, I really want to do this. It's never been done. This is like my first thing that I can do with the Spurs that's never been done. And he went out there and did it. And it meant something to him, just that little thing. And I'm like, man. This kid, he cares. He cares a ton.
It was cool when he was coming across the lane. He got fouled, and then he's like sitting on the floor, and he does the flex on the floor.
Who does that? Who has ever done that in Spurs history? You got to go back to Derek Anderson in 2000 to find a guy who was like kind of cool.
Well, perfect transition, because you mentioned Derek Anderson. if you are the sort of person that loves the NBA in a way that you don't think is normal, or the way that you like don't think your friends and neighbors could possibly understand, and if they knew you loved the NBA like that, they would like think that you're strange. this book is for you. You know, when I got to the, it's one line, but when you hit me with the, you know, Patrick Ewing covered in sweat 2 minutes into the first quarter, I'm like, okay, he sees me too. It's just, and there's literally 2,000 things like that in this book. It's an incredible read. I can't wait to now start rereading it for maybe I missed a footnote or something the first time. Give a plug or something before we get you out of here.
Oh, just everybody just go buy the book. That would be very cool if you bought the book. And that's really all. I just love talking about basketball, man. It just feels so – it's so good. It's so much fun. This season is already off to an incredible start. I was nervous after the injuries in the playoffs last year. Last year was such a good season. And this year, after everybody got hurt, you're like, shit, is this one going to suck? But then everybody showed up and they were like, no, we had a great time last year. Let's run it back. The game is in a great spot. The presentation is in a great spot. Like watching the Amazon Prime basketball show, and you're like, hell yeah, this is exactly what I was hoping this thing would be. Seeing Inside the NBA on ESPN, and they didn't. ESPN was like, we're not going to touch it. Do what you guys do. Hell yeah, this is exactly what I wanted. Even. Fucking Peacock. You got me subscribed to Peacock because I want to hear, they're doing the thing now with Bob Costas where he gives like a 45 second prologue before the game that makes you care about. I'm really invested in this Clippers game right now because I heard Bob Costas explain the history of the team in 45 seconds. And now I'm in, like, that sort of stuff is to me the best part of it. I'm in love right now. And Spurs are going to the playoffs. We're going to the playoffs. I can feel it. We're back, baby. We are back.
Well, in honor of you, as soon as I get you out of here, I'm going to join my boy Jeff. I'm going to go through the most expensive basketball teams of the last 40 years in honor of your current Spurs teams that like popped up and they're like right on the precipice. Ooh. They have the superstar. They have some of the other kids. We're going to do a little top five list. So that'll be in your honor, but I got to let you go. This was awesome, man. Thank you so much for popping on. The book again is Expensive Basketball, of course, by Shea Serrano. Thanks for everything you do. It is just incredible to have your voice as part of the landscape because it is a wonderful game and it's a beautiful game. But part of why, nuts like us love it is because we get to consume it through the voice and through the eyes of someone like you. So if you're Thank someone you, like man. That, again, who loves this stuff, go out and buy the book. Cannot recommend it enough.
I appreciate that.
Shay, be well, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Wait, one question.
Yeah, Another sure. One.
Who are your five?
Oh, you're
five
still on, but okay. Who am I? What?
We're still going.
Oh, yeah, wait, no. This is live.
I'm curious.
Who's my what?
Who is your well, I'm now I don't want to ask because it's going to spoil the next segment, but I was going to ask who your expensive basketball teams are going to be that you were going to pick. But I don't want to ruin
it. Okay, so I could spoil it because we're going to go through the list and then we're going to have a little debate. I think the two teams, yeah, I'll bring Jeff up now too. What's up, Jeff? Nice
Jeff. Pass. I don't know who Jeff is. What's going on, Shay? You could call me Chris, if you want to be formal, Christopher Smith, but I am the peacemaker.
Okay.
Well done. I did not wear my costume for this. I should have. I think the two teams that most come to mind when I think of the current Spurs are to me, it has to be the 93-94 Magic, not the 94-95 Magic, because the 94-95 Magic already, they were there already 57 wins. So I go with the 93-94 Magic. And then the one that's almost too on the nose, too obvious, is the 2009-2010 Oklahoma City Thunder. I'm pretty sure that was the year. The one where KD third year, Russ second year, Harden and Ibaka rookie year. But I have a whole list, but that's the tease. I think those are the two.
Okay. Got it. What's up, Jeff?
What's going on, brother? How you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I was not expecting to meet a peacemaker today, so it's going great.
It is the season. It is spooky season, so I have to be in character.
Jeff, what is your all-time favorite basketball memory? The thing you watched happen on a basketball court that was like, this fucking rules.
Ice Cube dropping a triple-double. Nah, I'm playing.
And the song?
I think in person, it would have to be Dante DiVincenzo's three against the Sixers.
Oh, like, you were
the
there for
building
that?
Was literally
the corner,
shaking.
The corner three?
The miss, the Hartenstein grabs the rebound, he throws it above the break.
Yeah.
Like, Shay, when I tell you, you know how people say, like, when Mike Green is like, the building is shaking right now. It's cap. Yeah. I was standing still, and you would have thought I was jumping the way the floor was hopping.
That's
up
great.
And down, up and down. The garden was apoplectic. I couldn't hear anything. It was an amazing moment. In person, that had to have been. I probably felt the way folks felt with LJ's four-point play in person.
That's probably
number one. Or when my guy Marshawn did the whole my nuts touchdown in Seattle, and they actually recorded on the Richter scale. That's how it felt.
So
that's probably in person. That's probably my all time moment.
Was it good?
I was never more confident in anything that when that ball was in the air, that Hartenstein was going to get that rebound. I would have bet my life on it that he's coming down with that ball. That was a beautiful moment. I can't believe y'all let him go. Sent him off.
Well, listen, trust me, we very much did not want to let him go. Unfortunately, the freaking owners who devised the CBA back in, or the current, whatever, whenever they devised that rule, the Bird rule, they screwed us over with that. But we don't need to get into that today.
All right, listen, I'm out of here. Thank y'all for letting me do a little extra.
All your pleasure,
thank
bro.
You for staying on to do extra. Have a great Halloween, trick-or-treating with your kids, the whole thing. And we'll talk to you soon, all right?
All right, later, y'all.
Thank you.
Later. All right. Hello, sir, Peacemaker.
What's going on, brother? How you feeling?
Now I can tell. Now I can say the behind the scenes part now that Shay's out of here. So I come down here in my setup early because I'm like, I got Shay Serrano coming on the freaking podcast. I got to be ready. And I go to my, you know, the studio, the whole thing. And it's not coming up. And I'm like, oh, that's great. The internet's down. So we got to go do the unplug and then the replug. Now I'm like kind of hustling. It's like 11:55, the whole thing. Go to plug in the mic. Mic don't work. Headphones don't work. Whatever happened in my home literally 15 minutes before that interview was supposed to take place, someone was playing a cruel trick on me. I don't know who I pissed off in a past life, but they got their last laugh today. So that was great. So which is why
I'm
doing
this. Did you get hit with an EMP? all your electronics went out at once. That's crazy. It wasn't
you would have thought it would have happened yesterday with the monsoon, but it was today instead. So that was fun, but I'm doing good. That was really cool to talk to Shay. You got to get yourself a copy of this book, man. It's just ridiculously fun. All right, so you want to do our little gimmick today?
Yeah, let's do it.
Look how I'm dressed,
John. If you don't think I'm ready for a gimmick, I don't know what to tell you.
If I didn't have that spot, I would have dressed up in my costume, which I can't quickly put on now because it may involve some facial hair maintenance. I will just say that. I'm just gonna
leave it at that.
I will send out a picture on Twitter later. Okay, so I kind of said already the thing when Shay was on, but I'll kind of go over it. So I figure we got Shea here. He wrote this book, Expensive Basketball, which, you know, and I kind of told you, it's like, and he phrased it really well. It's like the things you can't assess. So I was thinking about like, okay, what's something we could do in honor of this? And I thought like, to me, the most, if you're talking about expensive teams, and he writes about one of them, he writes about the 92-93 Charlotte Hornets. There are those teams that offer this like glimpse of endless possibility. Like, what could it be if they stay together, if everybody gets better? Like, you could tell already that they're really good. Like, they are of a certain level, but they're not there yet. That's why it's like imbued with the feeling of hope and wonder and all this kind of stuff. And I thought about it even more appropriately because that, as I just said with Shea, his Spurs are in that place right now where they're like, they're at the doorstep, like they're going to put a scare in someone. So I'm going to go through my qualifications for an expensive basketball team. You ready for this, Jeff?
Yes, sir.
All right. So have to have a super duper star, like potential future Pantheon level player in the first, I couldn't decide if it should be first 3 years or first 4 years. I went with first 4 years. One or two future stars on the team. At least one old head that is like still actively contributing, like as a meaningful play. So like on the current Spurs, that would be Harrison Barnes. Mm-hmm. The team makes sense. It's a good team. It fits together. Like they're a good team. They've taken like kind of a couple incremental steps, but then this is the year where it's like, boom, they've made a leap. No one wants to play them. They end up winning between 40 and 50 games. Very particular with that second number. Can't be more than 50. And then obviously this hasn't happened yet with the Spurs, but they are beaten by an older, more veteran savvy team in the first two rounds of the playoffs. So those are all the qualifications that I went through. Shall we go through my contenders?
Yeah, let's go.
We're going, we're only keeping it to 40 years because I'm not going back to the 60s and 70s for this. So first contender is the 87-88 Bulls. Fourth year, Michael Jordan, Pippen and Horace Grant were rookies. They didn't really have a Harrison Barnes level veteran. They did, however, have 38-year-old Artis Gilmore on that team, which I think is the funniest thing in the world. They went 50-32. Keep that number in mind. And they lost in the first round, or they beat the Cavs and they lost in the second round to the Pistons. The reason this doesn't quite fully match with the current criteria with the Spurs is Michael Jordan already finished very high in the MVP race the prior year. And this year he actually won the MVP. So it's like they were more than just on the doorstep because they already had the guy who would be named the best player in the sport that year. And again, Wemby could win MVP this year. So I wonder if maybe we're going to look back on this as like a good cop.
Yeah. I mean, this is year three Wemby, if I'm not mistaken,
exactly. Right?
Year three Wemby. It is only five games. They are 5-0. I respect it. It is only five games. So we don't know how the rest of the season is going to pan out. You know what? They do have the world champions in their conference, which is also a good comparison. Who is Pippen and Grant though on the Spurs? You saying Harper and Vassell?
No, I'm saying Harper and Castle. Vassell's really good. Vassell's really good, but I'm saying Harper and Castle.
Harper and Castle are your Pippen Grant comps. Okay.
Again, we're getting way ahead of our skis here. This is
right. But I can see that how analogous it could be. So. For sure.
So that's one. Next team. Shea wrote about them in the book. He has a whole chapter on them. The 92-93 Hornets, which is like in spirit, so I don't remember 87-88 Bulls. I know you don't either because we're about the same age. I know you remember the 93 Hornets.
Oh, yeah. Come on. LJ Zoe. Do you understand that the Charlotte Hornets jersey and starter jacket went diamond in the Northeast? It didn't matter who you rooted for. That was culture. If you had a Charlotte Hornets, they were undisputed best logo in sports, in American sports. They were up there with one of the most fire, most stylish logos and color schemes and apparel in all of sports for like that first half of the 90s.
Shay tells a funny story in the book about how the guy who designed, I think it was the jersey or like the color scheme or whatever it was. He was a dude that lived in New York, and they were like trying to work out how they would compensate him for that. And he could either get some kind of like royalties for that, but instead he made a deal where the Hornets would like send him a certain number of pounds of barbecue food up to his home in New York from Charlotte to compensate, like in perpetuity. And that's what he opted for instead of money.
Hey, man, barbecue will do something to you. I'll tell you, barbecue food will do something to you. I get it. Some things are worth more than money.
Exactly. So yeah, second year LJ, rookie year Zoe, third year Kendall Gill. Don't sleep on Kendall Gill. Obviously Muggsy. That team falls just below our criteria. They went 44-38, beat Boston first round, obviously the Zoe shot, and then lost in five games to the Knicks. The thing there is like they didn't have an all-timer on that team. LJ felt like
he might, that way.
He was trending that way, and then the back, so not perfect. Right. I just mentioned the 93-94 Magic with Shea. Second year Shaq, rookie year Penny. The veteran Scott Skiles started a bunch of games at point guard that year. What's the record? 50-32. I told you to keep that number in mind from the Bulls. Mm-hmm. The Magic, 50-32, swept by Indy in the first round. It was that 93-94 team. I remember it because that was my first year really watching basketball. And like, I was smart enough to know even back then, like, oh, the Knicks should probably do whatever they're going to do this year. Because once this team figures it out, this Magic team figures it out, no one's going to have a freaking chance. And that's what the current Spurs kind of remind me of.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like that because I still couldn't believe that they got the number one pick in back-to-back years and got Shaq.
It changed the lottery rules because of it, because they had to revamp the lottery rules.
Had to. It was just insane. And if things would have broke differently and Shaq never went to or never demanded the trade that sent them to the Lakers, who knows how the history of the league would look? Because if they could have figured it out, maybe Penny doesn't get injured. Maybe there's less of a load on him. It's a lot of
things, Penny.
But when I tell you that team, that was one of the scariest teams. Like even thinking about this year's Spurs, I don't know if somebody jumps off the screen other than Wemby on the Spurs like rookie year Penny did. And then 94-95. Like there's a comparison. I might be living in nostalgia, but I'm telling you from what I remember and numbers be damned, they had it. And then when they got Horace Grant, they had it, bro. They should have won a title.
Well,
they should have won a title. After those Nick Anderson's four missed free throws, psychologically, they were cooked.
I was about to say, we're sitting here still talking about game one against the Pacers a year ago. Who the hell knows how that series goes differently if Nick Anderson hits those free throws.
That's the type of torture I don't wish on anybody. I'll take game one Pacers over that any day, bro.
Well, game one of the finals.
I won't take either.
I'd rather neither, yeah. As far as young Penny, to give you people an idea maybe who are a little younger or don't remember, I remember when the NBA did their top 50 – Peter Vesey, who was still writing a lot at the time, did his own top 50. I think it was Peter Vesey. And included – and he had played like 3 or 4 years or something in the league. I forget what it was at that time. But Vesey included Penny in his like top 50 – not of the league at that time, but like his all-time top 50 based just on the beginning of his career. Because he's like, we've seen enough. This guy's the next Magic Johnson. The Penny hype, like, you know, that's what – that again – Castle and Harper, you put them together and maybe you get close to the Penny hype, you know?
Facts. Yeah.
No, he was incredible. Okay. Next team, and this team gets slept on because they were the same year as that Magic team. The Warriors, also 93-94. Rookie C-Webb, second year Sprewell, All-NBA. Mm-hmm. Veteran Chris Mullin. What was their record? 50-32. I'm telling you, keep
that's
the record in mind.
That's the number.
Swept by the Suns in the first round, but that was when Weber got the dunk on Barkley. You thought they were coming, you know? You thought they were, like, on the way, and then it didn't.
And you want to talk about one of the all-time could have been one of the best win-win trades in the history of the league.
Oh, it should
where they traded where the Warriors and the Magic made the trade, swapped Penny and C Webb, and they had both coasts on fire. Like that Weber dunk on Barkley, and then the Nike commercial, the Express Yourself commercial. Yep. If for those of you who've never seen it before, YouTube it, go Google it, do whatever you gotta do, find it, because that was like the essence. It captured the essence of basketball culture at that time. Like it was super fire. You thought these two teams were gonna have their respective conferences in a chokehold, and then a cold might be.
And then what happened?
A double entendre.
Okay, and then I was about to say, and a couple of months later, it really showed how basketball, like a snapshot of how basketball was back then, because they traded C Webb coming off of that rookie year because he didn't get along with the coach. Yep. And it's like the notion now that you would trade a guy like that coming off of that rookie year who you gave up all that to get after one season. And like, that's insane. You look back at it now, but it's like, that's
wouldn't happen now.
No,
I tell you that much.
Okay. Next one. And again, this really, to me, hits at like the spirit of the feeling of the Spurs right now, even though, again, this is another team where it didn't pan out. The 97-98 Wolves, third year KG, second year Marbury. Mm-hmm. The veteran was Tom Gugliotta, who, again, Googs once upon a time was like a guy, you know.
Before so Wally, Googs had Long Island on lock.
Dude, you ain't kidding. They had some old heads too: Terry Porter, Sam Mitchell. 45-37, lost in five games to Seattle, and then of course we know the Minnesota thing didn't quite work out for either really Kevin Garnett or Stephon Marbury, but really not for Stephon Marbury, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another team. Like there's been a lot of young, fun teams in the league, man, for sure. So is that the fifth one?
I have five, so we're halfway through. That's the fifth one.
That's the third one.
No, so we got the Bulls, Hornets, Magic, Warriors, Wolves. Yeah, that's
okay. Oh, you have a 10.
I got 10, man.
Oh, okay, cool. I thought you said five. That's why I was like, I was about to start throwing names out, but I'm sure you got them.
No, we're gonna come up with a top five after we're done with this. So next one I got is the 99-2000 Raptors. Again, young, exciting team. Second year Vince, third year T-Mac. Mm-hmm. And listen to this list of old heads. Ready? Charles Oakley, Muggsy Bogues, Kevin Willis, and Del Curry.
Group right there. That's the super vet group.
That's super vets. 45-37 swept by the Knicks in the first round. Again, the Raptors like arrived the next year, but this was the year where you're like, oh, this VC T-Mac thing might be something. That's why I included this version of the team.
I like it. That I feel like I don't know if the Spurs match with this one as much, just because
Wimby's too
Vince good. And T-Mac were kind of established by then as like known well, players to watch, not like as who they are, but known players to watch. Like, remember, if I'm not mistaken, didn't that dunk contest happen in 2000?
Talk about another thing that Shea writes about in the book. Yes, the 2000 NBA dunk contest. So it happened during this Raptors season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So after that, it was all eyes on Vince Carter. Yeah. Like that was a dominating effort. So I can see the similarities. I can see them better now. But then once again, I'm like, Dylan Harper.
Now I'm telling you, man. I think I'm just way too high on both of their young guards.
No, they're nice. Like, but I can see maybe 5 years from now we'd be like, oh yeah, it was better. Like with the being able to zoom out with history on our side. But there's nothing wrong with trying to prognosticate it ahead of time. Like I get it. Like I like Castle and Harper, man. Those are some guys. Like, I just don't know how the Spurs keep getting away with it. I should have told Shea that I don't know how you motherfuckers keep getting away with this shit.
They sold their soul to the devil. That's the
I had to. Well, someone on the river, he was on the river walk waiting for souls, and they just offer them every year just so that they can get a number one pick every generation.
Exactly. And the right number one picks, too.
The right number one pick.
We're not talking about, you know, Anthony Bennett or, you know,
Odin,
Bargnani.
Right.
You know, who's the, oh, Risha Shea might be good. We'll see. Anyway, okay. Next team, 03-04 Houston Rockets. Again, a team that kind of gets forgotten about because Yao didn't pan out. But if you think the Wemby hype now, like the Yao, if the Wemby hype right now is a 10 out of 10, I feel like the Yao hype over the first couple years of his career was like a 9.2. So this year is his second year Yao, fifth year Steve Francis. So it's a little, not again, outside the bounds of our qualifications. He was a little bit too old by that point. And then Katino Mobley was like the vet, big time contributor. Again, some old heads on this team. Weatherspoon, Jim Jackson, Mark Jackson, Charles Oakley finished 45-37, lost 4-1 to LA in round one. But I remember the buzz about that team.
So yeah, this was the pre-T-Mac Rockets with Yao, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
For sure.
They were good, man.
Yeah. No. And when you say about the hype, like when people speak in absolutes and they'll say something like, we've never seen this before, you got to live a little and do some research because Yao Ming coming over from China.
Dude.
Being like 7'3", 7'4". And those first year, huh? Are you 7'6"?
Yeah, I was 7'6".
So I see, even I undersold it. 7'6". His first game against Shaq was like Clash of the Titans.
Oh my God.
It was like Clash of the Titans, bro. Like they, when I tell you the hype was real about him, and I wish his feet would have held up so that we could have seen what he could have became. But the flashes, man. There's a lot of teams that have titles in that era that are lucky that Yao's feet gave out.
Yeah, shout out to Jeff Van Gundy, who coached some of those teams. Okay, three more. One of them I mentioned, the 09-10 Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Again, third year KD, Russ, rookie Harden, and Ibaka. What was their record? Wait for it. 50-32. Lost to the Lakers in round one. Obviously, the Thunder would arrive the next year. I think if Harden would go on to win an MVP. Westbrook would go on to win an MVP. Serge Ibaka would go on to like be, I think he won a Defensive Player of the Year, if not more than one. So like to sit here and be like Harper and Castle are going to be that is it sounds insane, right? And yet we didn't know those guys were going to go on to do that stuff. So if we're just comparing, again, that feeling that watching this Spurs team gives you as an impartial basketball fan about what might be possible, this, I think this Thunder team is where it's at.
Yeah. To me, this one is the one that I thought of when you talk about like young teams who you think they're a year away from being next. Man. Yeah. That Thunder team, I still think if they were able to kept all three, they would have won a title a long, long, long time ago. If they were able to keep all three of those players. It's how many? Yeah. But I do think, funny enough, the league overall may have been better that they broke up and they were able to grow and blossom on their own and reach their full potentials individually. If you're more so I like super teams, I like dynasties, then you probably missed out on an OKC one and traded it for the Warriors.
You know what's
but yeah.
Like Harden's career as a superstar, he's going to go down as one of the most derided superstars in NBA history. Right? Because of the playoff failures and because, I mean, most just the playoff failures, like to an extraordinary degree. Russ has kind like, he had obviously a period of time where he was awesome. He was an MVP, triple-double, the whole thing. He was never meant to be a number one. He was always meant to be a number two. So like, I hear you what you're saying with like, it was better for the league because it was maybe more parity. But those three guys, I really, like, they belong together. It made sense, right? That they were on a bat, like they fit. And I think it could have, I don't know, with egos, but I don't know, man. It's arguably the greatest what if in the history of the league. It's up there. It's top five.
Oh yeah, for sure. I agree with that. I think it's the immortal question of, would you rather have multiple rings or be regarded as one of the best players in your era? Because despite what people say, the game changed for James Harden. James Harden was an instrument of change with the foul call rules and all that. He hacked the system. Westbrook, for all what the geeks want to say, he made history and changed the outlook of the truth. So much so, he made it look so easy that folks started to devalue them until Jokic and Luka came along, which I still think is bullshit to this day. But I can see a side, but I do think it's bullshit. But still, he made history. And then Kevin Durant, he was the one who actually went to one of the team that was able to get him his couple of rings. But he was an MVP as well with Westbrook, and then a Finals MVP, right? So I get what you're saying. I think overall, those guys complemented each other so well that we deserve to see at least one more run. Like the year that they traded Harden, I wish they wouldn't have traded him that year.
Wow.
We deserve to see one more year of them fully formed to see what they could do.
And that's why it's like, talk about basketball karma not existing. The team that traded James Harden for luxury tax reasons is the same team that got to take advantage to bring up what Shea just brought up of the Knicks not being able to keep Isaiah Hartenstein because they can't go above a certain amount because of CBA bullshit. None of it's fair. Okay. Two more quickly. Some recent ones. The 12-13 Warriors. So again, pushing it a little bit because it's fourth year Steph. So he'd already been around for 3 years. Second year Clay, rookie Draymond, and Harrison Barnes was also rookie on that team. The veterans were David Lee and Andrew Bogut, 47-35. And they beat, obviously they beat Denver and they lost to the Spurs in round two. Mm-hmm. Again, in spirit. But I guess the difference is that group, it didn't really hit until the playoffs, mm-hmm. where everybody saw it. And it's like, oh man, this Steph thing is real. The Wemby thing, the Spurs thing is hitting right now. So that's why I think it's a little bit different there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that those Warriors were still doubted even after their first victory. Because I'm old enough to remember that run to the first title. Folks were ready to throw asterisks all over it because every opponent that they faced had to deal with some injury, which you cannot blame the Warriors for. I can tell you as a Knicks fan and through my multiversal travels, I've seen other scenarios where the Knicks are the team that is the most hated on the planet because of success. I could tell you if the Knicks had a run, if the Knicks had a run, the Warriors had to win a title, I wouldn't care what anybody had to say because they still won the title. Everybody got to deal with something. I think when Steph hit the MVP year, that's when folks was like, oh yeah, we in the midst of something, because LeBron was still considered an inevitability. I think they got their respect, but it's like, yeah, they're the now. They're here now, and there's no more sneaking up. They're good, and we're going to have to deal with them. And then they started hitting a whole bunch of threes, and nothing in this world was the same again.
And it still isn't. What was cool about the Steph thing is like there was hype coming out of college. Then the hype went away because of injuries for him with like the ankle stuff. And then there was like the first jump. That's the 12-13 season. It was like mm-hmm. the jump that came like leading up to the playoffs and in the playoffs. And then it like stayed there for a little bit. And then there was like this meteoric jump after that where he elevated into like, oh, we've never seen like this guy's revolutionizing basketball and he's doing things that we never thought were possible. And then the last team is because I want an even number, even 10, the 2014-15 Pelicans, which, again, seems like a silly team to mention now because nothing became of them. But if you remember at the time, it was AD in his third year. It doesn't fully fit because there wasn't an – this is the only team without a second, like, young stud on the roster. They had Drew, but Drew was already in his sixth year. Then right. Some other older guys. They finished 45-37, swept by the Warriors, aforementioned Warriors, in round one. But again, you had just, again, going with the feeling, to use Shea's term, of like what you felt watching that Pelicans team.
Was that CP3? Was that a CP3 year?
No. This is it. This is post CP3, right? This is post. Yeah, this is Anthony Davis. He was after he was the number one pick. He was like injury plagued rookie year, like good, like pretty good second year, I think. But this was the third year where he really hit. And it was just everything was on his back. I was like, oh, this guy's going to dominate the league for the next decade because he's finally putting it all together. But that was short lived because the Pelicans franchise can't get out of its own way. But that'll be a topic for the show for next week, perhaps.
So it's all about the Saints, bro. It's the Saints come before anything.
let's do top three, and then we'll
okay.
Again, we're going for that spirit of like evokes the. They're kind of here now, but it's also about, oh my God, what is the next 10 years going to look like for this team? And we're thinking about how we felt in the moment with each of these. Sure. I think the Thunder or the Magic have to be number one.
I'm with you. They're 1-2 in my mind.
Who goes ahead? Which of those two? Which two in the mind? Again, they're 25 or 15 years apart, 16 years apart. Which one were you more in the moment? Like, if this hits, it's over. I think I want to say 93-94 Magic.
Oh yeah. When they got Penny, I remember they played the Knicks in Orlando, and there was a play where somebody missed a shot and Penny grabbed the rebound, drove baseline and hung. And I think it was like a right-handed jam over Patrick Ewing, like one of those ships passing in the night poster dunks. And I said,
I remember that one.
Oh,
too.
Damn. Yeah. Oh, damn.
It was not pleasant. It was one of those where it was like, oh, Patrick might be getting a little old for this shit.
Yeah, they were running it. They were running it in Orlando on the Knicks. And this is a Knicks team that was perennial contender. And they were running it on the Knicks comfortably. And I said, oh, God, we finally got Jordan out of here. Yeah. What is going to happen with this Magic team? If they stay together, they're going to be a problem. And at this point, you're going to have to hope that teams cancel each other out and you pick up the scraps at the end. With OKC, I felt like that after they lost to the Heat. When they lost to the Heat in the finals, I said, these boys are going to come back. We might see a rematch, kind of like what happened with the Spurs. We might see a rematch, and they're going to take it. And then
weren't fully there yet in 09-10. It was another year it took.
Yeah, I was tapped into the Magic. Shaq was one of my favorite players. Shaq was one of my favorite players. Like, this dude was it, man. Like, he gave me the feeling that kids are getting from Wemby now, of that unstoppable force, that's super cool. Like, you think Wemby with the Tibetan monks was cool. Shaq was on his side quest mission game, but way, like, after season one, he put out a platinum rap album. He shot movies. This was all within a span of an off season. Like,
so there was the albums, multiple albums, right?
Yeah, but that first album was the one where he just got his favorite artist on, and they wrote for him, and they spit their own lyrics. Like, you listen to "You Can't Stop the Rain." That's probably one of the best Biggie guest verses on a Shaq album. Like that's why I said this dude was a force of nature. Like, you knew when his playing days were over, he was going to be a world-class entertainer. Like, it was already, that was cemented. He was going to be a Hall of Famer, one of the best ever, and one of the greatest entertainers of all time. And he's one of the guys that I hope does not get lost to history because of this three-point revolution. because that was dominance. That was the type of dominance that people are projecting Wemby to have. He had it first, breaking backboards. They had to reinforce the stanchions on the hoops because of Shaq. Like he shut down games for like 45 minutes because they had to go get a whole new basket, a whole new basket because he broke it. Like it's very different, man. I was tapped in like that. They are probably my number one.
I think they have to be. I mean,
matching the hype for sure.
They have to be. It has to be because the combination of Shaq and Penny, and again, Castle Harper. They're not young Penny, not right now. But I think maybe it's the fact that they have both of those guys. And we haven't even mentioned Fox, but like I think that's okay. So Magic number one, OKC number two. Number three, who should we put at number three?
I'm leaning the Hornets. I'm leaning those 92-93 Hornets. It might be a reach for your criteria.
It's not a reach because in the moment, LJ, Zoe, and Muggsy Bogues felt like these three guys are going to be the best trio in the league, like not in 5 years, in like next season, you know. It was. Again, people like I remember there was like a painting in Charlotte of like the three of them on like the side of a building. Mm-hmm. I distinctly remember from that era. And it's like it made so much basketball sense. And it just they were a young team. And the fact that they beat the Boston Celtics, now it was the vestiges of the Boston Celtics. It was like the ashes after the fire already burnt out. But it was still the Celtics. You know, and they whooped up, not whooped up on, but they beat him in round one, and then they ran into the next, and that was it. It was like it was over as soon as it began. I'm down. I was either going to go the Hornets or the KG Marbury Wolves. Again, similar promise, feeling like, oh man, these two guys make so much sense on a basketball court together, and then but same thing. It feels, and it's crazy how many of these teams. Like of all the teams that I listed, again, kind of based on this like super specific criteria, the only one that won a championship, the only two, the Bulls and the Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, where they like built it with this young, like a young superstar and then a young secondary piece and then like a couple of vets. And, you know, it goes to show this shit is hard. But
yeah. And not to mention, because of this current CBA that I believe is in place for the next decade.
It's here for a while.
At least for a while, right? At least the next decade. I think they lined it up with the TV deal, if I'm not mistaken. It's probably like staggering or whatever, but it's here for a minute. It's here long enough to say the Spurs have a window. Don't get it twisted. They have a window because if Castle and Harper pop the way a lot of folks think they are going to emerge, you're going to have to pay them. They're giving Wemby a billion. You already know that. Wemby's getting a billion. So what are you going to do with the rest of them slots? Because I do believe if there's even a whiff that Wemby might leave, everyone's clearing their coffers. Like it is going to be the fire sale of a century around the league.
I don't think he'll, because they're so stable and they have such an asset chest. It's like, no, the question that you're asking about the Spurs is the question that people are already starting to ask about the Thunder, but that's why the Thunder locking up their big three.
Right.
And also they have this pipeline with the picks. They have like a couple other young players. Like, so if they need to jettison a Hartenstein or jettison a Dort, or if like Cason Wallace he's going to be too expensive to retain. Like they're in a good spot. The Spurs, the interesting piece there, and I don't want to go over what we just talked about because we talked about it with Fred Katz, is the Fox piece and the fact that they already have a max player on the roster. But again, that should be fine because they're not going to need to worry about the contracts of Castle and Harper until the Fox deal, maybe not is out, but it's like basically out. So,
right.
To your point, they have to play their cards right, because if they don't play their card, like if they don't play their cards just so, you know, like they have to play their cards just right. Mm-hmm. But if they do, man, again, the feeling you get when you watch one of those teams and you're like, it's over for the rest of us. You know, can they keep it together? We'll see. Happy Halloween, man. Thanks for hopping on, midway through this one.
For sure.
Anything else before we get out of here for the weekend?
No, just once again, thanks everybody for tapping in. Be sure to subscribe. If you're just watching this passively on X or any other network, go to our YouTube page and subscribe. The more subscribers we get, the more content we can create for you, the more people find out, and the more we grow this community. So definitely tap in with us there, and all of the podcasts, anywhere you get podcasts, you will be sure to get us. So however you want to support us, definitely do that. And John, you will be on the post game on Knicks Film School tonight, right?
The NBA post game. I will be on the post game on Knicks Film School. I got to do a quick hit for SNY, should be right after the game ends. And then I'm immediately going over to do the post game for Knicks Film School. The question will be, can I look the part for SNY and then transfer to my costume for the post game in like the span of 30 seconds flat?
I think you should wear the costume on SNY with the suit. If it's compatible with the suit, I think you should do it. I would wear this with a suit. I do wear it because I am the peacemaker. So
it is not compatible with the suit. I'm teasing folks, but I
oh man.
Let me just say I'm proud of this one. This is a homemade costume. So if you want to see what it is, I'll tweet out a picture.
If it's what I think it is,
there's no way you know what this costume is.
Okay. Cool. Then, yeah, that's going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Thank you for dressing up today, Jeff. I've said it to you offline. I'll just say it to you on the show. Thanks for being along with this, with me on this journey so far. It's been
Thank you for having me.
How long has it been? This is our third or fourth week doing this?
It's got to be at least the third week, yeah. It's probably week three.
Yeah. So, I think it's going pretty good so far. So, thank you. Shout out to Sean, who was on the episodes earlier this week. We'll be back with some more great stuff next week. Again, shout out to Shea Serrano. Go buy the book. It's so good. You can get anywhere bookstores. You can order it on Amazon, the whole thing. Everybody have a happy and safe Halloween. And I think that's it. So we will be back soon. Until then, everybody, take care.